Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did with dancer, singer, actor, director, choreographer, Dwayne Barrett, who is currently directing A Chorus Line. In this show, you will not only hear my interview with the charming Southern boy, but you'll also hear some music from A Chorus Line. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice. Prodding from the voice, oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
The Lynn Show is about self-discovery. In a way, it's about courage. The courage to ask yourself the question, am I all of who I really am? Am I living the life that my innate nature, my innate talent, my given essence would have made possible? Or was there a lesson that I learned from my family of origin, from a teacher in school, from the culture I was raised in, from my siblings or my peers, from my religion, from something I read or heard, from some traumatic event that occurred in my life that told me not to be who I really am? Was there something that happened to me early on in my life that discouraged me from pursuing the things that turned me on? Maybe even something I knew that turned me on at the very beginning of my life. If you've been listening to my interviews, then you know that so many of the people that I interview, people who make their living or their life with an art, knew at two what they were meant to do, what they were drawn to, what they had passion for, what they yearned to be part of. I played the interview with Joyce Valentine, who sat down and played at two what her mother had been teaching a seven-year-old student. This was not negotiable. Joyce knew that the piano was the place for her, virtually from the time she could stand, apparently. And this is not that uncommon. I hear this story a lot from musicians, ironically. People who started playing at two or three or four. But I also hear this from fine artists, people who picked up a pencil or a crayon or something and were doing amazing things with it and could not actually be parted from it. I think it was Gail Fulton Ross who tells the story of how her mother had to put her crayons and drawing stuff outside, otherwise she couldn't get Gail to go out. And so it's just not uncommon for people to discover so young, so early in life, what they are drawn to, what they have a passion for, what speaks to them. I think it was Kate Alexander, a brilliant actor, who told me that she remembers sitting on a stage. She had gone to see a performance, and she was on the stage with her feet hanging over the stage, thinking, this is where I want to be. I think she was seven. She didn't really know what acting was, but she knew that she wanted to be there. So, this is not uncommon, and yet, unfortunately, few of us are given the encouragement to follow our natural inclinations. And this doesn't just apply to talents, abilities, skills that we might have been drawn to or attracted to or that spoke to us. This is also true, perhaps even more true, to ways of being. Did you laugh out loud at the kitchen table? Did you laugh so hard at the kitchen table that food spilled out of your mouth or your nose or something? And then were you told in no uncertain terms that that kind of laughing is a bad, bad thing? Leave the table or just don't do it or something? And so did you decide that a certain kind of explosive joy was not for you? That you were not to feel that, express that? Did you get angry or hurt or cry or frightened? And did you hear from a religious person or a teacher that was not good behavior? You were not to get angry. Anger was the devil's something, or was unattractive, or didn't get you anywhere, or maybe you were even punished for it. Go to your room. Who do you think you are? Don't do that. And of course, this, you know, applies across the board to every kind of behavior, every kind of impulse. Did you want to read all the time? And did someone tell you that that was not okay? I interviewed a writer once who told me that he would write these little stories when he was quite young, 6, 7, 8, and hide them around the house. And that his mother found one of them, and in it he had said some things about a neighbor that weren't true, it was fiction, but they weren't very nice. And his mother was horrified and forbid him to write again. In this particular case, it didn't do any good. This was Stuart Kaminsky, who prolific doesn't begin to describe Stuart's output. And unfortunately, we could have had so much, much, much more from Stuart, but he died much too young. But he did leave us a huge, huge legacy. And if you're not familiar with Stuart Kaminsky's work, especially if you like mystery fiction, run right out to your local library and read Stuart Kaminsky. So we hear these things, we get these experiences, things happen to us in our childhood which discourage us from
not only doing, acting, behaving in certain ways, but from being ourself. And when you get the idea that something about you is bad or wrong or dangerous or ugly, something about you is going to bring a response that is definitely not the response you want. It will not bring love or affection or care or nurturing. It will bring criticism or embarrassment or neglect, and in some cases punishment or trauma. Well, when you get the idea that there's something about you that is really not good and is going to bring a consequence which you really don't want, well, you grow up at odds with yourself. You grow up, first of all, unable to use those skills, those talents, those qualities, those abilities, those ways of being, even when those ways of being are laughing or crying. So you grow up without being able to access that, which would be bad enough. But you also grow up thinking that you are basically flawed. You may not remember, and in fact, that's what happens. To begin with, we try and hide this behavior or this way of being or this talent, and over time, we simply forget we have it. We forget who we are. We forget who we are. But there's the lingering sense that there's something about us that's not okay. So you're not only cheated out of the things you could do or be, but you're stuck with a feeling that there's something wrong with you, something bad about you, something you need to be ashamed of, or something you need to hide. So the Lynn Show is about making this point. It's about saying these things happen way too often. If they happened to you, if you know, for example, that you stifle your sense of humor, that you have things to say but you don't say them because you're shy, or because when somebody asks you a question, suddenly you are numb, you are paralyzed, you can't think of what to say. Or that when you need to stand up for yourself, when you're not being treated well, or when you have something that you deserve but you're not getting, but you can't seem to get the words out, you can't seem to say, I want that, I need that, that's mine. Or maybe you can't stop people from treating you badly. Maybe you don't know how to say no. Or maybe the flip is true, that you always say yes, even when you don't really want to, even when later you regret it. If any of these things are true for you, it may very well not be too late to recover what you have lost. But the first step is awareness. The first step is recognition. And that's really what the Lynn Show is about. It's about making this point. It's about saying, if any of these things or similar things are true for you, can you consider the possibility that something about your childhood caused you to create a way of being in the world that's, I call it, a cover story? It's the truth, but it's not the whole truth about you. Something that happened in your childhood forced you to create a cover story that you are living out instead of the real you. And if that's true, maybe you even know when you ask yourself, was it something someone said? Was it something someone did? Was it something you observed? As a therapist, I quite often treat people who were youngest children, who are very timid, very frightened, although nothing bad ever happened directly to them, but an older sibling was punished, and they observed it. Or parents were very disappointed by an older sibling, and they promised themselves that they wouldn't do that to their parents. And so even though these things didn't happen directly to them or by them, they created a cover story that's not who they really are. So if this sounds familiar, if this strikes a chord, then it may not be too late to recover whatever it is you left behind. In this show, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. Because in order to be an artist in this culture, even to spend some of your life following your art, you have to really be it. We make it much too hard for artists. And so it is the identification, the true identification with who you are that allows them to do it. And this is entirely true for the very fortunate and very talented and very charming Duane Barrett, who had a childhood full of encouragement, full of joy at what he did naturally and spontaneously, what he enjoyed and they enjoyed for him. So this interview with Duane, I'm doing it this time because he is in Sarasota directing the musical Chorus Line. And I am not only going to play Duane's interview, but songs from A Chorus Line. And we're going to start out with what I think is probably the best known song in the show, and that is What I Did for Love, followed immediately by Duane's interview.
Kiss today goodbye. The sweetness and the sorrow. Wish me luck the same to you. But I can't regret what I did for love, what I did for love. Look, my eyes are dry. The gift was ours to borrow. It's as if we all I won't forget what I did for love, what I did for love. Gone, love is never gone. As we travel on, love's what we'll remember. Kiss today goodbye and point me toward tomorrow. We did what we had to do.
What I did for love.
here with Dwayne Barrett, who is a dancer, an actor, a director, a singer. It's all right, right? It's all right?
All around.
All around. It's all around. He's a theater guy.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, good. I am explaining to Dwayne that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And clearly, the art to which you are giving your life, right?
Right.
Is the theater.
Hmm? Exactly.
Okay, good. So when I only ask one question, and that is, do you remember the very first moment in your life when singing, dancing, acting, telling stories, being looked at, any of that happened to you, occurred to you, drew you? Do you understand what I'm asking?
Oh, most definitely.
Oh, really? Good. Tell me.
I can tell you, and I was 5 years old.
Oh, my God. Tell me.
And I remember it. I can see it. And there used to be pictures of it, but along the lines of many years of storage units and living in New York City, I lost a lot of those pictures. Mm. But they're still embedded in my mind, and I remember it like it was yesterday. Because, again, as adults, we don't always remember everything we did as kids,
no.
But there are those trigger moments. Mine was, I was on Romper Room.
You're kidding. The
yes.
real Romper Room?
Well, the real, like we all say that we were on the real one. It was WDEF TV 12 in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Oh my God.
I was born and raised in Chickamauga, Georgia. And Georgia, Alabama, and Tennessee on the map are so close together that we would just drive up to Tennessee. It was only like a 15-minute drive. And that was kind of like my kindergarten. And
how did that happen? Do you know?
I think I just remember my mom always saying that she saw it on TV and she wanted me to be a part of it. And I think they already knew that I had the bug to be a performer. Because I remember also at that age, they would get me up on the kitchen table and have me do the monkey and the twist and the jerk and all of the mashed potato.
Even as a little boy, like three,
four,
four,
yeah,
right,
three,
right,
four,
right,
five.
Right, 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 right.
Mm-hmm.
So this was spontaneously you were doing this and they liked it.
They did.
Yeah, so you were getting not only I really like this, but they really like this. Oh, that's wonderful. Okay, so your mother said you should be in Romper Room.
Be on Romper Room.
So what does a kid do in Romper Room?
It's just like the shows that today that would kind of parallel to those would be like Barney. Do you remember Captain Kangaroo? The Electric Company, Newsy Review. Romper Room was like the beginning,
yeah.
Like that TV show of getting kids on, having them do songs and mimic people and stuff. And I remember it. I can, even right now as we're talking, it's there. And I was 5 years old.
Okay, so what do you remember?
I just remember the TV cameras.
Oh, really?
I remember my first disappointment because when you watch the TV show at home, and then when you're there on set, you find out the little tricks. So the little things that you saw at home, and then when you saw it in person, I remember being let down going, oh no.
It's not magic.
Yeah, because it was when Miss Clara had the magic mirrors, and every kid in America wanted her to say their name. And it was Romper Bumper, Stomper Boo, tell me true, magic mirror, tell me today, did all my friends have fun at play? I still remember these
yes,
words.
Yes, you do.
Okay? And then on TV, a little swirly thing would come up, and she would put one of the magic mirrors behind her back, because the one that she would look through at the TV had no center in it.
Oh, my.
And I remember me, and I remember all the kids' faces being like, oh, wow.
It's not.
And then that's where I think it hit me that I'm going to do this.
Really?
As a career.
Oh, my God. Okay, so we have this clear revelation, right? This is mine. Okay, so then what? Did you get acting lessons, dancing lessons, nothing?
Well, again, being raised in a Southern family with seven brothers and sisters.
Oh, my. Where are you in the...
Number one.
You're the oldest?
I'm the oldest.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, again, being raised in a Southern home... you know, in the 60s, because I was born in 64. And I love the fact that my parents did recognize my talent, and they never said, no, you can't be a dancer, you have to be a football player. Because, again, I have four other brothers, and they all became the football players and all that. So my family recognized the talent and never said no and let me pursue it.
So what did you do to pursue?
Well, again, being from a kind of a southern town, there was really no opportunities mm-hmm. where I was living at that time when I was younger until we moved to Cartersville, Georgia, which is closer to Atlanta. That's when it took off when I was probably 12 is when it really started taking off and I started getting scholarships.
To dance.
To be a dancer.
So did you study at all?
Before then, no. It was just mimicking.
Right. You were just copying?
Yeah.
You saw that and you could...
And I could do
it. I can do that?
Yeah. I could do that. Yeah. And even to this day, I still have a photographic memory that when I see something, I can remember it and emulate it like the next day.
Wow.
Yeah.
You can make your body do what your mind remembers.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So, when you say you got a scholarship to a dance studio?
To a dance studio. Uh-huh.
And scholarship because, I mean, did you apply?
Well, yes and no. Like, to be honest, coming from the southern states, if you were a guy back in those times,
right.
back in those times,
right.
They would give you scholarships because they wanted guys in the studios.
Yeah.
So, and even when I moved to New York City in my 20s, I auditioned to be on scholarship at Steps on Broadway, which is the big dance studio. And out of hundreds of people, I got accepted, so I was able to be on scholarship in New York.
Oh, my God.
So I didn't have to pay for any dance classes.
Oh, my God. Well, wait a minute.
And I could take as many.
Okay, so now we're moving from, we jumped from 12 to 20.
Yes.
So just take me through the a thumbnail of... From what happened, I mean, so you got the scholarship and you're studying dance.
We're going back to when I was younger?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I got the scholarship to study with Iris Hensley mm-hmm. and the Georgia Ballet Company, as well as the Atlanta Jazz Theater, which is a jazz company in Atlanta. So I was going back and forth between ballet and jazz.
Wow.
I love my ballet training. I think that's the basis everyone needs, but... I think from being on Romper Room and just being a showbiz personality per se, I knew I wanted to do more than just being a dance company. So, and I could sing, so I started in high school. My drama teacher was also an acting coach and a director at the Harlequin Dinner Theater in Atlanta, Georgia. So I started going there and I started taking acting classes. And then in high school, I took voice.
So you were studying all through high school. It was clear you already knew this is mine. This is what I'm going to do, right?
I knew. Right. Oh, I knew.
And you did, and you took all these classes. It's pretty amazing.
I did.
Okay. So by the time you graduated, were there plays in school?
Yeah. I was the president of the drama club.
Yeah.
We did a spring musical every year. And then my senior year, I was actually, my director let me basically direct the show and even choreograph. I was even choreographing in high school. I choreographed the show choir, the majorettes, the musicals. So I was even choreographing then. So I've always known.
You've been working since you were 15, right?
I have.
Yes.
But yeah, so I just like a doctor who knows he's going to be a doctor,
right.
I knew this is what I was supposed to do.
Right, okay. So, and you were diligent.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Okay, good. So then, so you graduate...
And passionate.
And passionate, clearly. So you graduate from high school,
mm-hmm.
and then...
And then I went to college, but I didn't go to college to be the drama or the dance. I chose my college because I wanted to march in their band. Because as well as playing the saxophone, and I was drum major in high school, I could also... because I could twirl a baton, I could twirl a rifle, and I can twirl a flag. So I wanted to get that under, like, one of my goals. I wanted to march in drum corps. I wanted to go to, I saw this band, this college band at a competition, and I saw they had guys in their rifle line, and I said, I'm going to that school.
Wow.
And I did.
Now that's amazing, because it's not a direct trajectory to the theater.
Exactly.
Right? It's more about something you do with your body? Do you know what I mean? Or not? Was it the performance aspect of it that turned
no,
you
it, No, it was the fact that I had this talent of being able to twirl a
and
rifle.
And you wanted to use it.
And I wanted to do it.
Ah.
And I did.
Yeah. Right. So you went to this school.
Mm-hmm.
And you majored in...
I was majoring in musical theater, and then my father got really ill. So I went to school there at the university for a year, and then my father got ill and had a heart attack, and so I moved back home, and then I went to a community college, which is now, it's called Kennesaw State College. Was a community college, but then now it's a big university college, so it's really big. And then that's when my career took off, and I moved to New York.
Well, how did it take off?
Just people discovered me
in the
dance company that I was dancing with in Atlanta.
You left that out. So you're in...
No, at the Georgia Ballet and the Atlanta Jazz Theater.
They discovered
that.
You there.
Yes.
Oh.
We had a choreographer come in from New York, set a piece on the company, and he said to me, you need to be in New York.
Wow.
If you want to come to New York, I'll have a job waiting for you and a place to live.
You're kidding.
And I went.
Wow. So you, this is not common that you went to New York and already had a job.
No. A lot of people save their money or...
Right. Or scrimp and save,
yeah,
right.
But I had a job
so
and...
What was it?
On a cruise ship.
Oh, lovely. Mm-hmm. So, how long did you do that?
I did cruise ships off and on for 15 years. Another one of my goals. I don't want to say it's a bucket list.
Right.
But it's goals that I've set for myself.
Yes. So cruises was a goal.
Yeah.
Amazing. The same line, different lines?
Different lines. Different lines.
15 years.
Royal, the first ship I worked on was Royal Viking Line, which is no longer around, but everyone knows Royal Viking. Mm-hmm. Silver Seas, Seabourn, Crystal.
Oh my.
I even worked on a Japanese ship for a year and lived in Japan for a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're doing what you want, right?
Always.
Okay, so was it continual, the cruises? Or were there places in between and you did other things or breaks? And
yes, there were. So, yeah, it wasn't a consecutive 15 years. Because a lot of times with cruise ships, you would do 6 months on.
Mm-hmm.
Or 8 months or 9 months. Some people even do a year. And in between that, because I am an equity actor, I wanted to be able to keep my health insurance. And
right.
In order to do that, you have to work a certain amount of weeks.
Right.
With the union. So I would at least try to do one or two equity shows a year.
Okay. How did you get your card?
I got my card playing Riff in West Side Story in 1989 over in Boca Raton from Jan McCart, who used to own the Royal Palm Dinner Theater, which is no longer around. So that's how I got my equity card.
And how did you get that gig?
Auditioned in New York.
Oh, gosh. All right, so this is what I hear. I hear that you are a working actor and performer for this entire period, right?
Of my life?
The whole period of your life?
Yes.
Exactly right. Okay, good. So, how did you get here?
How did I get here? I got here through Charlene Clark. Don't know if you know the name or not. She was the resident choreographer at the Golden Apple Dinner Theater.
Yeah.
With Bob Turoff and everyone. And Charlene and I worked together in the Pajama Game over in Miami in 1996. And she said to me then, I want to work with you again. We got to make this happen. So after that show, I went back on the ship. Fast forward from 96 to 2000. We would still stay in touch, and I got a call one day from her, and she goes, Bob, who you met in Miami, is doing some shows in Sarasota, and we'd love for you to try to come in. It's Chorus Line and 42nd Street.
Mm-hmm.
So it worked out. I flew down from New York to here in 2001 to do Chorus Line, And then from then on, I just fell in love with Sarasota and would come in and out a lot and do shows until I finally got the bug and just said, I really want to live here. It's like a second home for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it.
Oh, well, we're very happy to have you. And currently, you are directing or Chorus Line, right?
The New Theater.
At the New Theater, is exactly right.
Which you're doing your show at.
Yes, and you're choreographing mine.
Yeah.
Right, yes, right. Okay, but we'll talk about Chorus Line, and we can talk about my show another time.
Okay.
And are you also performing in it?
I am. I'm actually also playing the director.
Yes.
Zach.
Typecasting,
yes.
So, yes.
Which
yes.
I've actually played that role before, so it's fun that I'm going to be able to do it again.
Yeah.
And as you're interviewing me right now, you could probably will see that I'm trying to grow a goatee.
I see that because it's appropriate for the role.
Exactly.
Right? Okay.
And the last time I played Zach, for some reason could not grow it.
I see.
It won't grow in, you know, but now there's a little gray in there.
It'll be perfect.
Color it
a little bit. It's all right for him to have a little gray.
No, well, we'll see.
All right, okay. So talk about the show as though whoever is listening hasn't seen it.
Well, I think for the most part, I think everyone has seen the show, or at least know of it, especially people who are in show business.
Mm-hmm.
But it definitely is a show that chronicles the life of a Broadway gypsy, mm-hmm. a chorus person who goes to audition. It's basically a show about people auditioning for a chorus spot.
Right.
So it's not really a show about where they're auditioning for a lead. They're actually at an audition to be a chorus member.
Yeah, and primarily dancers, no?
No. I mean, it is definitely a dance show, but you have to be able to sing and act also.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Most definitely. You have to be triple threat.
Right. So do you know the story of how Chorus Line happened?
Oh, yeah.
Why don't you tell? Because I'm pretty sure that even those people who have seen it don't know that.
Okay. Well, back in the beginning, Michael Bennett got together all the people who have worked with him before and said, hey, I want to workshop this show that I have an idea for, so let's all get together and powwow. So they all got together and sat around and, you know, had a glass of wine and, you know, talked and just started talking about showbiz and their lives and their careers and shows they've done together and just everything about themselves, their life,
their
childhood, their personal experiences, everything. And that turned into be what the show was about. So during the course of the actual show, the character Zach, who's the director, which is modeled after Michael Bennett, starts asking everyone personal questions, like an interview. And it was funny because when they actually started those meetings where everyone just got around a group and started talking, Marvin Hamlisch, who was the musical director, was in on the meetings and, like, in his brain started thinking, okay, like, for example, you, Lynn, would start talking and all of a sudden Marvin Hamlisch would have this patter of music of what he thought your voice sounded like with music.
Wow.
So, for example, Deanna Morales, her song Nothing, he's talking to Deanna, and then all of a sudden he starts hearing her song in his head just by her voice.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, so everything about the show, music-wise, comes from the people's tone and their voice and their personality.
So it grew up, it grew from this, right?
Oh, totally. It grew from just people sitting around talking in a little circle in an apartment, drinking wine.
Yeah.
To one of the longest running shows in Broadway history.
That's right. And it does give people who are not in the business a really good idea of what it's like to be a gypsy.
What it's
like to try and make a life and a living out of being in the chorus.
Oh, most definitely, because you go through these emotions of the audition, especially for like the character Sheila, who's going to be turning 30, and she thinks her life is almost over.
Right.
her life as a chorus member's over. And it, even myself, it's a special show because as I'm getting older and I'm doing it again, hearing those words and those lyrics and those moments in the show where you say to yourself, what are you going to do when you can't dance anymore?
Right.
You know? And one of the characters says, kill yourself.
Yeah, right, right.
And then another character says, I'm just going to go on kicking these legs for as long as I can, and when I can't, I'll just do something else.
Yeah, yeah.
So it really tugs at so many actors' emotions.
Yes, yeah. And in that way, it gives a perspective to people who don't do that to see what it takes.
Oh, yeah, it's hard. Yeah, it's hard work.
It's hard work.
It's hard work,
and it's, as you are pointing out, it's time limited.
Yeah.
Because you can't dance forever.
Exactly. And for me, again, I have always known I'm going to be a director choreographer. Mm-hmm. Just like a doctor knows he's going to be a doctor.
Right.
A dentist knows he's going to be a dentist. I've always known this is what I'm going to do. So for me, I haven't been scared about what I'm going to do in the future.
Right. Because you weren't only a dancer.
Right.
Right. So you knew where you were going to take it. Right.
But as far as being a dancer, though, as I'm getting older, I get sad. I don't want to say I get jealous, but like when I watch So You Think You Can Dance, or if I see West Side Story at the Oslo, when I see all those young guys that they're dancing, you know, I've done it, but I want to do it again.
Yeah, right.
But I can't. I just have to do it in a different form.
I remember you saying that you had to stand in for somebody at, I think it was Catch Me If You Can, mm-hmm. and you thought to yourself, who choreographed this?
Yeah. Yeah, because I'm dancing, and I'm like, oh yeah, that was me, that's right.
Right, because your mind can still spin that.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
So the show itself is so important, I think, because it makes this point, because it's real, mm-hmm. in addition to the fact that it's terrific entertainment, mm-hmm. it's wonderful music, wonderful dancing, mm-hmm. all choreographed by our...
Michael Bennett.
Yeah.
Michael Bennett. And the thing, too, it's a show that I just feel like every dancer who can sing and act, they need to do this show.
Yeah.
And I actually have one gentleman in the show who has auditioned for the show, or for some reason, time or money or whatever the case is, could never do the show.
Wow.
So now he's getting to do it.
Oh, my God.
And it's like now he's fulfilled all his bucket list dreams of shows.
Yeah. Well, all right. It opens on
January 7th, mm-hmm. and runs through January the 24th.
Okay.
Performances are Wednesday through Sunday.
All right. And, all right. Well, come out and see it.
A Chorus Line, singular sensation.
So before I continue my interview with Duane, I'm going to play another song from Chorus Line. This is The Music in the Mirror. I play it now because it so makes the point of what Duane and I were talking about the importance to people who make their living with an art to be able to do that work. And Marvin Hamlisch captured Cassie, and of course Donna McKechnie, who originated the role, in this beautiful song, The Music in the Mirror. And then I'm going to go on with Duane's interview.
Give me somebody to dance for. Give me somebody to show. Let me wake up in the morning to find I have somewhere exciting to go. To have something that I can believe in. To have someone to be. Use me, choose me. God, I'm a dancer. A dancer dances. Give me somebody to dance with. Give me a place to fit in. Help me return to the world of the living. by showing me how to begin. Play me the music, give me a chance to come through. All I ever needed was the music and the mirror and the chance to dance for you. Give me a job and you instantly get me involved. If you give me a job, then the rest of the crap will get solved. Put me to work, you would think that by now I'm allowed. I'll do you proud. Throw me a rope to grab onto. Help me to prove that I'm strong. Give me the chance to look forward to saying, hey, listen, they're playing my song. Play me the music, give me a chance to come through. All I ever needed was the music and the mirror and the chance to dance.
I ask one more question. And that is, having given a life to this work, and it's clear that you have given your life, virtually from the minute that you could, you have given your life to this work, is there anything you would say about what that's like?
Given that chance to do this, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's definitely very rewarding. I sometimes have to pinch myself, especially when I was working on the cruise ships. I got to sail around the world. Mm-hmm. I got to go to places that, as a kid, I never dreamt I'd go to, like Loch Ness.
Mm-hmm.
I had a fascination with the Loch Ness Monster, and then to be able to be there and see it, and then you step back and you go, wow, I'm dancing, I'm being paid mm-hmm. to do this, and I'm seeing the world.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times I have to pinch myself, and I also sometimes feel guilty because I'm getting to do these things that people have saved their whole lives for. I feel guilty that my brothers and sisters are back home and they're having to work a grueling job sometimes, working in factories and mills and things like that.
I know the feeling that you're describing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I, you know, I'm really happy that you're talking about it because not a lot of people talk about this, and I think a lot of people experience it. I'm trying to remember a story I heard about Mel Brooks.
Yeah, Mel Brooks.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
In his early, very, very early in his life, he got a job writing for, I think it was Sid Caesar,
mm-hmm.
you know, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He came from big-time poverty, and he was suddenly making what was essentially a huge amount of money to write funny lines,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And suddenly, he started to have bouts of nausea. For no apparent reason, he would get sick, and he would throw up. And, you know, when he went to all the doctors, and there was nothing wrong with him. And finally, he went to a therapist. And what came out of all of that was his feeling that it wasn't fair that he was getting to do this thing which he could do easily, which he loved, to make a lot of money, where he came from this poverty. All those people are still stuck in this poverty.
Exactly.
Right, right. And I've never heard anybody else except Mel Brooks talk about that, but I think it's very common. I think that, you know, that in this culture, a lot of people think about work as something that you don't like to do, but you have to do it. And some people get an opportunity to do the work that they love.
Right.
You know?
Right, right.
So,
guilty is that's it. Feeling guilty, that's the word I was looking for.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I suppose I would like to say that when someone like you gets an opportunity to do, what they love, it's role modeling for everyone else. So maybe the people that you came from don't benefit from it, But everybody who sees you, mm-hmm. everyone who sees the joy and the pleasure and the passion with which you do what you do, mm-hmm. that gives the message to everyone who sees you that it's possible. Mm-hmm. So I don't think you have to feel guilty.
That's great. But yeah, I mean, I used to feel, even like when before my mother passed, I would even feel guilty about not being able to go home to see her.
Yeah.
But all my aunts and uncles and my brothers and sisters, they were like, your mother is so proud of you. Mm-hmm. You know, they want you to do that.
Yeah.
You know, they want you to succeed. But yet there's that part of you that still feels guilty.
You make another point, which I think I like to highlight, and that is that what you got from your family was encouragement and support and
always.
Never, right? And it's that makes the difference for everybody. You know, the people who don't get that,
right.
yet they are continually between a rock and a hard place
mm-hmm.
because they want the thing so badly. On the other hand, they got the feeling they shouldn't have it.
Right.
You didn't get that.
Right.
You didn't get that. You were very lucky.
Yes.
Yeah. And we are very lucky because we have you.
Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you very much,
Thank you, Lynn.
So there you have the not only delightful and articulate and charming, but the remarkably talented Dwayne Barrett. And if you have not seen Dwayne's work, really run right out to see A Chorus Line. So, as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show, something that tickled you, interested you, piqued your curiosity, something you didn't know which you now know, something that inspired you, something that will bring you back, because as always, I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I hope you will be too. We're going to go out on yet one more song from the score of Chorus Line, the one that Dwayne alludes to earlier, One Singular Sensation.
One.
This is One from
Singular
A Chorus Line.
Sensation, every little step she takes. One thrilling combination, every move that she makes. One smile and suddenly nobody else will do. You know you'll never be lonely with you. No. Second best to none, son. Ooh, sigh, give her your attention. Do I really have to mention? She's the one.
One singular sensation, every little step she takes. Every move that she makes. One smile and suddenly nobody else will do. You know you'll never be lonely with you. No more. Moment in her presence and you can forget the rest.
Kick.
Step, brush.
Palm up.
5, 6.
Back, back.
One, two, three, toes.
5, 6.
Steps and
change to
step.
Hold up.
Set, sit,
and
fall into
the second step.
see I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go. My shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. Going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten